6.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Today on Radio Time, something new and different. Excerpts of interviews from the last 6 months that you enjoyed. I invite you to listen and become a member supporter of WHYY at 1-888-345-9499. It's our early spring mini membership drive. We begin with popular crossword puzzle maker and wordsmith Merle Riegel. You'll hear how much he loves language and the joy with which he approaches words. You'll also hear me laughing a lot. I asked him about the very first crossword puzzle published in 1913.
The very first crossword puzzle was Shaped Like a Diamond. It appeared in the old New York World. The guy who did it was a guy named Arthur Wynn, who was a puzzle guy. He had grown up in Liverpool, England, wanted to be a newspaper guy and came over to America when he was 19. And when he was on the New York World, he had a special, you know, weekend, a holiday coming up. So he did this puzzle that was shaped like a diamond. He numbered the clues in a strange way, but he numbered them. We don't do that today. There was no horizontal or vertical then. That came later. But one of the answers, I mean, he had a lot of unusual words in this puzzle. You would think with just 32 words, you could do common words, but no. One of the answers like neif, N-E-I-F, which I've never heard of.
Is that a real word?
It is, I guess, in Scotland.
Was?
Tane, T-A-N-E, and things like that.
And was it popular from the get-go?
Yes, instantly. It was originally called a word cross. And due to a typographical mistake in the second or third week, it came out crossword, and Arthur Wynn liked that better. So that sounds better. So they stuck with crossword, and they immediately got tons of mail about it. It was a huge success. But when Arthur Wynn said, you know, we should copyright this or something, you know, but his bosses at the World, which included the sons of Joseph Pulitzer, said, no, it's going to go away in a year. That's a fad. It's going to disappear. Why copyright it? So, and Arthur Wynn, even when he died, he said, I'd never made a penny off the crossword puzzle.
Wow. Well, we should also give some credit to a woman named Margaret Petherbridge. That was her maiden name.
Right.
And she really, it sounds like she kind of not just popularized, but also, I guess, what, regularized crossword puzzles?
Yeah, I would say standardized.
Or standardized.
Yeah, and when Arthur Wynn turned the puzzle over to somebody in 1921 or 22, it was to a Smith grad named Margaret Petherbridge, who wanted to be a journalist. Last thing in the world she wanted to do was to be the queen of the crossword puzzle. So she just let it ride for a year. She just put in the ones that were the most unusual shapes and didn't edit them until, you know, they hired this great columnist named Franklin P. Adams. And Franklin P. Adams was the most popular columnist on the world. And he would come in every Monday morning and throw on her desk, you know, all the mistakes she missed in the puzzle on Sunday. And she had finally been shamed enough after a year to look at the puzzles, and she couldn't solve them. And so she said, okay, well, I better clean these up. So she set down a bunch of rules, almost all of which we still go by.
Is that right?
Yeah, and that standardization has held for almost all these years. She's the one that started across and down. They called it horizontal and vertical at the time, but to have the across clues first, the down clues second, to do the numbering normal, not like
don't
Arthur.
Fill up the whole space,
right? Right. The very first crossword, if you ever see a copy of the very first crossword, which is on Wikipedia, yes, the numbers were so big in the squares you couldn't write the letters in. That's one thing. The second thing was he put a number at the closing square, too. So you started in this square and you ended in that square. So the clues were things like 1 to 8. If there's no letters, if there's a black square there, right, there's no reason to have the ending spot. And she happened to be there when two guys came to her in 1924 to do a crossword puzzle book. The first ever crossword puzzle book. And these two guys were named Simon and Schuster. They'd never published the book before. It was a double first. First ever crossword book, first ever book published by Simon and Schuster. That was an instant success. 400,000 copies in 4 months, 2 million copies in 2 years. You know, so that catapulted Simon and Schuster into the publishing biz.
And we should say Petherbridge then married a Farrar, right?
Yes, in 26, I think it was Margaret Petherbridge who co-edited that first crossword book and all the Simon and Schuster series books up through 134. She married a guy named John Farrar, who was, I think, in publishing at the time. And so as Margaret P. Farrar, she went on to be this publishing...
Farrar, Straus, and Giroux,
that's right. And when the New York Times, after the New York Times for years in their editorials would cut down the crossword saying it was a waste of time, this was in the 20s, you know, it's like people should have better things to do, it's going to go away soon, hopefully, you know, but in 1942 they finally gave in and started a crossword puzzle on Sundays, and they hired Margaret P. Farrar to be the editor.
And you started doing crossword, I guess creating crossword puzzles when you were what, 6 years old?
6 years old, yeah.
Wow.
We used to get the Philadelphia Inquirer, these big, huge Sunday Inquirers, stacks of them at something called the Berlin Auction. Now, this wasn't an auction. It was like a long building. It was really more like a flea market in Berlin, New Jersey. And on Friday evenings, they would have stacks of the Inquirer, of the Sunday Inquirer. I said, how did they do that? How did they know what the news is going to be on Saturday and Sunday? But they had a magazine in there that had a big Sunday crossword in there that had gray black squares. And I said to my mom, I'm going to be this puzzle someday.
Wow.
And when I was 10, and today I am.
Indeed you are. But obviously you were a kid that understood language. And I know you have a very playful approach to your crossword puzzles, very humorous as well. But are you, and even as a kid, were you one of those kids that was just constantly kind of turning words over in your head?
Yes.
And absolutely. Maybe even today?
Oh, yes. That never goes away. It's an affliction that never ceases.
Like a punster, right?
Yes, I like puns. But I mean, it's also one of those things where you see race cars, the same frontwards and backwards. Not just words like level and madam. Those are all kind of famous ones. Right. But race car, as we would say, is the same in forward and reverse. To me, like, the English language is the best toy a kid ever had, because there's so many unusual things about it. There's so many words that are funny. You know, why do we say broad daylight? Of all the we know daylight is broad. Why the word broad daylight? Why is an amateur always rank? Does he smell? You know, why? It's always a rank amateur. Why is a...
I'd love to be inside your brain for a while. I mean, probably pretty...
You might regret it, but yeah. Yeah, but there's a lot of things about language that's just strange. I don't know why we say head over heels in love. Aren't we head over heels right now?
Yeah.
Sitting here?
Yeah.
You think it would be heels over head in love. You know, like you're crazy, like flipping in love. But,
right.
But just sitting here in love is not right. Why is your pocketbook called a pocketbook? Is it a book?
Is this how you work on a puzzle? I mean, when you're writing a puzzle, is this what's happening with you, which is just you're just accessing the world of words?
You kind of go through a lot of little automatic things. There's anagrams, there's reversals, there's all kinds of things. I mean, you mean the fact that golf backwards is flog? I mean, this is a famous thing, because flog does mean to whack at something repeatedly. That sounds like golf, you know, the way I play. But that's just accidental. But, you know, it's just strange things about language. Why we say things? What things happen when you just accidentally drop a letter off? You know, egrets, I've had a few.
Yeah.
What an alligator would say. Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe. They're hiding everywhere. They're actually just waiting to be found. And if you have the time to look, like me, you can find them. One of my favorite words is gubernatorial, especially when Jimmy Carter was president.
Yes.
I mean, goober is a peanut. You know, I can't imagine that when he was governor of Georgia, every time they had gubernatorial in a headline, that the headline writers must have cracked up. Gubernatorial.
I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but is there a crossword puzzle of which you are most proud?
Most proud. Boy, oh boy.
Well, you just felt like, I nailed it.
Well, I've done that many times, and especially the ones that I thought would never happen. There was one puzzle, and I probably can't remember it, but there was some of these puzzles sometimes take 10 or 15 years to actually happen.
Really?
Yeah, I have lots of little notebooks that I write puzzle ideas in. There was one that was about a kindergarten crime spree, because I noticed that the word finger painting, finger pointing, and finger printing are almost all the same word except for one letter different.
It's true.
And I thought, well, finger painting, finger pointing, because I was watching an episode of some cop show, and they said, well, now the finger pointing begins. I thought, oh, finger pointing, finger printing. But the finger painting part put it into a kindergarten. So I thought there must be some sort of story I can do where there's some sort of little crime in a kindergarten where the climactic line will be, and now the blank begins, and you can put an A or an R or an I, whatever it is that right? Finger point, or an O, whatever
oh,
it is,
yeah.
In that square, and it'll still work. No matter what letter you put in there, it still works going down.
So it sounds like you think of your crossword puzzles as a kind of story. I mean, as a kind of narrative. You have titles, Snacks on a Plane,
yes.
Repeat Business. I'm just looking through your book, George Steinbrenner for President, Cliché Combos.
Yes. Well, they're harder to do because the story has to make sense in a symmetrical way. We have all these rules and puzzles about symmetry. I've done all different kinds of those. Did one. Remember when we say we have to pardon the turkey?
Yeah.
You know, well, my question was,
Obama's.
What did he do? You know, every year we pardon a turkey. What was, did he, you know, jaywalk? You know, they're all bird jokes. So first he must have jaywalked, then he must have sold beer to Minas, and then he must have...
Oh, to Minas?
Minas, right. And then anything illegal, eagle in it, and then got in trouble with the migration laws, and then he was robbing banks, you know, so there's all these stupid bird puns.
Is this a good sort of therapy outlet for you for
crossword
puzzles, so you can get all this stuff out of your brain?
Well, it's sort of like being a sit-down stand-up. comic, you know, because a lot of these things are things you can actually say on a stage if you wanted to, and I just don't have the temperament to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like giving talks, but I like just doing what I do. And that's funny because you have to have the temperament that makes people work for the joke.
Yes.
You know, you're not just writing it down for people to read it. Solvers kind of are like the holders of this secret that these puzzles are funny, but only they know it.
Do you think we're kind of in a word nerd period? And I think of, you know, spelling bees. Now they're shown on ESPN, yeah. Scrabble, you know, all these interesting kind of mathematical word competitions.
Right? Yes, it doesn't hurt that the word nerd and nerd do rhyme, you know,
does
so word nerd is a term.
It?
Well, it's the internet just makes everything kind of homogenized. So if they weren't out there before, at least we know about them more now. And language is so changing so much. I mean, we have so many interesting words coming in and coming out. Nanny cam, the old days, gas guzzler. Right.
Selfie now.
Yes, right.
A new one.
Selfie. Alpha male. I mean, there's so many different, you know, so many colorful things. I like the ones like generica, which is the traveling from city to city across the country.
Yeah.
The same brand names come up and the same billboards, and this is like generica. I like that idea of like prairie dogging, you know, people who work in cubicles, when something happens, they all pop their heads up.
That's great,
isn't
it?
All these colorful terms.
Because you can see it.
Blame storming. After you've had a real serious meeting, then you go in the other room to see how you screwed up. And so blame storming happens.
As opposed to brainstorming,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so I mean, I just love all this stuff.
Well, apparently our listeners loved Merle Riegel as well. I'm Marty Moscoane with Christine Dempsey. And today on Radio Times, it's the best of Radio Times. We looked back over the last 6 months to find the interviews that we knew that you enjoyed, and Merle Riegel was one of them. It's a mini membership drive here at WHYY, taking a couple of minutes to talk to you about the importance of membership here at WHYY. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be playing an excerpt of one of my favorite guests, Salman Rushdie. But in the meantime, we want you to make a phone call right now at 1-888-345-9499. We truly have a room full of volunteers. The members of the Cosmopolitan Club of Philadelphia are here. They want to take your phone call. We need to make up for some lost time and money from the last membership drive. And of course, we can do that with your pledge of support.
And you do that by calling 1-888-345-9499. 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. Here is the goal for this hour. We are looking for 80 calls by the end of this hour of Best Ofs of Radio Times. So we're expecting you to call because one of the best things in the world is listening to a radio program. I'm sitting here listening to this great interview and laughing out loud, and I look over and Marty is just looking at me with this big smile on her face saying,
"Snacks on a plane!"
saying, you know, it was a good interview.
Yes, it was.
And it was fun to listen to. He was a great guest. And that is why this was a popular episode of Radio Times, and that's why we want you to support it. Not just for this episode that has happened in the past, but for future episodes of the program. This show is rare. It is not common that a radio program can spend as much time as Marty does with a guest, and it's possible because of you, because of member support. And more than likely, you're not thinking about calling WHYY right now. It wasn't on the top of your list. You didn't know that we were going to be here asking for your support, but we are here. And the truth is we do need your help. That is the only way a program like this remains on the air is because of member support. We fell short in the winter. We are here in the spring, although it doesn't feel like it, but we are here in the spring asking for you to help make up that loss. And it only happens with one phone call at 1-888-345-9499 or going online to WHYY.org.
What was interesting, Christine, when you looked back over the last 6 months to find the shows that people really, really liked, they were also the shows that we, as the producer and as the host of Radio Times, we really liked as well. So it's nice to know that we are on the same page with you, our listeners. And if you hear some urgency in our voice, it's because we're feeling it. And we do need to make up for some lost ground earlier this year. We can do it. We know that you listen to WHYY. We know that you listen
listen to Radio Times. And it's very important to meet all these goals. We want to get this mini membership drive over as quickly as possible. And, of course, we will do it when you make a pledge of support right now. And, again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. And you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We have the folks from the Cosmopolitan Club of Philadelphia. They've given up their morning to be with us, and we really appreciate that. We know that you listen to Radio Times. We know how much it means to you when we do a program that's about the Delaware Valley or something happening around the world, or we introduce you to some interesting people, because you email us, you call into the show, you send us tweets, you're on our Facebook page. So we know that we're all in this together. We do need to have you make that next step. Make a call right now, as that caller did, at 1-888-345-9499.
1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. 80 calls, looking for 80 calls at this time is a challenge. I'm not going to deny that. It's a challenge. But the bottom line is there are plenty more than 80 people listening, or 800 people, or 8,000 people right at this moment. I am not talking to them. I'm talking to you, because you are listening to Radio Times, and you enjoy this program, and you value it, and you know that a host like Marty Moscowane doesn't come by every day. She is here on public radio on WHYY because of you. She's here for you and because of you, because you became a member. If you haven't done that yet, you need to do it now. 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org.
In fact, Radio Times is 27 years old.
How is that possible?
How is that possible?
You were three when you started the show.
Well, it's possible, Christine, because people supported this program. People inside this building supported the program, and listeners did as well. To be perfectly honest with you, we kind of learned on the air. We had to get some of the kinks out early on, but we're here for you Monday through Friday, live every morning from 10 until 12. We introduce you to interesting people. Salman Rushdie, in just a minute or so, will be the guests that we're going to highlight during this Best of Radio Times. We keep you up on the news. We did a program yesterday about the flap involving Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. We've been talking about all sorts of things happening here in the Delaware Valley, across the country, around the world. That's why you listen to Radio Times. That's why you listen to WHYY, because that's what we do every single day. We do need to hear from you right now at 1-888-345-9499. And again, you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We want to hear the phones ringing. We want to put the phone volunteers to work. And of course, we want to hear from you. Well, one of my favorite guests is Salman Rushdie. I've interviewed him several times, and he always has something intriguing to say. He also has a great sense of humor. We spoke last year about his memoir, Joseph Anton. That was the name he chose when he lived under a fatwa. We begin with a reading from his book.
Afterwards, when the world was exploding around him and the lethal blackbirds were massing on the climbing frame in the school playground, he felt annoyed with himself for forgetting the name of the BBC reporter, a woman, who had told him that his old life was over and a new, darker existence was about to begin. She had called him at home on his private line without explaining how she got the number. "How does it feel," she asked him, "to know that you have just been sentenced to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini?" It was a sunny Tuesday in London, but the question shut out the light. This is what he said, without really knowing what he was saying. "It doesn't feel good." This is what he thought. "I'm a dead man." He wondered how many days he had left to live and thought the answer was probably a single-digit number. He put down the telephone and ran down the stairs from his workroom at the top of the narrow Islington row house where he lived. The living room windows had wooden shutters, and absurdly he closed and barred them. Then he locked the front door.
And that's Salman Rushdie reading from the very beginning of his memoir called Joseph Anton. And I have to say, because you refer to yourself in the third person, I had to keep orienting myself. Was Joseph Anton, did that feel like someone different from Salman Rushdie, and that's why he's a he and not an I?
In a way, yes. I mean, first of all, that was a much younger self. You know, I mean, this happened to me when I was 41 years old. You know, it's a quarter of a century ago. And so there's that. And also, you know, that younger self was innocent of everything that happened to me afterwards, you know. So it's a sort of simpler person, you know, without the burden of experience that he then acquired. You know, so, yeah, I wanted to say that the me writing the book is a slightly different person than the me being written about, you know, partly because of being older, partly because of all that experience, and partly because of being in a better place in my life, you know, being able to reflect in tranquility and write about it calmly.
Your minders, if I can call that, they called you Joe, which you did not appreciate. Joseph Anton, they referred to you as Joe.
Yes, it was bad enough having to have a pseudonym, but to have a diminutive of the pseudonym. I don't know, there are friends of mine who say that that's kind of ridiculous. Why does it matter which one it is? But it sort of did.
But as you read there, and as we certainly know about you, you lived under the threat of a death sentence for about 9 years.
Yeah, or even more, really. But it was... you know, a lot of people, particularly in England, began to feel that because I hadn't been killed, that nobody had been trying to kill me, you know, that it was all exaggerated. But the fact is, first of all, that it wasn't only I who was threatened, you know, I mean, the publishers of the novel, its translators, etc., were under threat in many countries, and there were attacks.
You know, in fact, a translator was killed.
The Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his college late one night when he was working late. The Italian translator was seriously attacked and was very lucky to survive. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot 3 times in the back and survived by a miracle. And as you know, there were attacks on bookstores around the world, including here in the United States. You know, I mean, Cody's bookstore in Berkeley was pipe bombed. You know, there were firebombs in other places too. It was a very, very real attack.
Did you feel, though, during that time, I mean, did you have... not regret so much, but a sense of responsibility. As you said, I mean, people paid, in certain cases, almost with in one case, with his life.
Well, you can't help feeling, you know, that if friends and colleagues of yours are being threatened and attacked, you know, you can't help feeling responsible. But I remember very well when William Nygaard, my Norwegian publisher, had recovered sufficiently from the wounds for me to be able to speak to him on the phone. The first thing he said to me was, "This is not your fault." He said, "You know," he said, "I'm a perfectly grown-up person. I knew what I was doing when I published your book. I'm very proud to be the publisher." You know, and then in true heroic publisher style, he said, "By the way, we've just ordered a very large reprint." And I thought, to say that from your hospital bed when you've got 3 bullet holes in you is a genuinely courageous act.
You know? Do you think the critics, did they understand the book or did they misunderstand the book?
Well, many people didn't read it. Many people were just pointed in a certain direction by extremist priests and just believed what they were being told and went that way. I mean, there are 1 or 2 cases I quote in the book of people much later who had been involved in the protests coming up to me and saying that they had since then had actually read the book and they couldn't see what the fuss was about, even though they had been the people making the fuss. You know, so that was frustrating. I mean, I think what's fair to say is that the relatively short part of the Satanic Verses that deals with this material in a dream sequence is, if you like, a kind of dissident view of the birth of a religion, because I'm not a religious person. So I'm looking at religion and the phenomenon of revelation from someone who's skeptical about it. And I guess there are people who don't like that.
But you also seem to say that Khomeini was using this fatwa for his own political purposes Iran.
I don't think that's even really in dispute anymore. I mean, this was not long after Iran's Iraq war had ended in a kind of debacle. And the revolution was probably in more trouble than it's ever been, you know, since it happened. And he was looking for a way to rally the troops, you know, and it was just as my bad luck to be Khomeini's last stand.
Right. A sort of a diversion for him.
A diversion for him in a way of kind of re-energizing the faithful. And that, unfortunately, turned out to be me.
I got the feeling that, and I don't want to go too much out on a limb on this, is that this fatwa was the beginning of extremist acts. I'm not saying it led to 9/11, but there might be a circuitous path from this fatwa to,
you know,
something
I think
like 9/11?
I think there's pretty much a straight line, you know, actually. I mean, one of the things that I try and show in the book is how that line goes. That something which began as what seemed like a bizarre, marginal, kind of one-off, weird thing you know, which didn't seem to be symbolic of any larger project, you know, how we gradually can see how that project enlarged. And I think I came to think that what happened to me was a kind of prologue. And yes, the 9/11 attack was the main event, if you like, you know, but you can, I think, see the growth of that kind of malevolent, kind of medievalist assault using modern technology, how it grew during those years. Many other people were attacked all over the world, and then climaxing in this terrible event in America.
Is it sort of strange to think that you were so well guarded during this difficult time? I mean, yes, you certainly lived under the threat of death, but you also were surrounded by guards who moved you from place to place.
Well, the British Special Branch, not only are they very good at their job, they're actually very proud of their success rate, because as they would tell me, and actually it was very comforting to hear, that in all the time they had protected people, they had never lost anyone. So they had 100% success rate. And they were rather scornful of the Americans. They said, if you look at the Americans, they have far more manpower, far more resources. But, you know, they lost one president. They had another one hit. And that has not happened to us. You know, that we have never lost anybody. And I wanted very much that they should keep their 100% record.
Which clearly they did.
Which they did.
But you have to, I guess, learn to live with people that are, sitting in your kitchen?
Sitting in
the car with you?
I mean, I think it's I talked over those years, I met with, you know, a lot of people, politicians and so on, who received this kind of protection. And the thing that everyone said is the two hardest things to deal with are the loss of privacy, you know, because you have strangers in your home.
All the time.
All the time, day and night, and the loss of spontaneity. So it means you can't do anything on the spur of the moment. You know, if I'm writing a book and I'm feeling stale and, you know, I need to freshen my head and I want to go for a walk, I would have to say that. And they would say, okay, well, just give us an hour and a half and we'll set it up and you can go for a walk.
Wow.
And I would think, I don't want to go for a walk in an hour and a half. I want to go for a walk now. An hour and a half from now, I want to be working again.
You do write with some degree of honesty about the stresses on your family, on your children, certainly. You've had four wives. I mean, it seems that it's been difficult to hold a family together under these circumstances.
Well, it was very hard to be a father, that's for sure. You know, I mean, my older son was not even 10 years old when this happened. So in many ways, this happened to him, too. And he was a child. You know?
And he's living with his mom, right?
He was living with his mom. But, you know, she and I had to very carefully shepherd him through this, you know, and I think actually he came through it incredibly well. He was really, you know, his school was incredibly supportive. His friends were very supportive. I mean, this was a collective act, you know. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here in reasonable shape if it weren't for the support of people who cared about me, you know, my friends and family. And we were all trying to help each other through it, but it took a lot of doing.
But it seemed that also writing stories for your son helped you as a writer, maybe as a father as
well.
Yeah,
I think it helped all of that, yeah. Because, I mean, I had promised him that I'd write a book that he would enjoy. And
nice gift for a son.
Yeah, why don't you write books that I want to read, Dad, you know? and I thought, good question, you know? And that became Haroon and the Sea of Stories, which, I mean, strangely, given that this was maybe the worst year of my life, it's my happiest book.
Is it?
You know, it's the most cheerful, optimistic. It's the first book I wrote which has a fully fledged happy ending, you know. And I guess I was really interested in happy endings at that moment. And of course in making him feel happy.
I'd love to have you read another section, and these are about the armed guards. I guess the changing of the guards.
Yes. I mean, it's who knew that I would end up with so many close friends in the British Secret Police, but I mean, it's true. There had been a change of protection team. Stan, Benny, Dennis and Mick had gone back to their families, and he was now in the care of Dev Stonehouse, a character with a face suffused by the colour of what looked like a drinking problem, full of scurrilous, loose-tongued tales about other principals he had taken care of. The night the Irish politician Jerry Fitt drank 16 gin and tonics, the intolerably high-handed behaviour of the minister Tom King towards his prot team. That chap might get a bullet put in his back one of these days. And by contrast, the gentlemanly behaviour of the firebrand Ulsterman Ian Paisley, who remembered everyone's names, asked about their families, and prayed with his protection officers at the start of every day. In Dev's team were two more smiling, gentle-natured drivers, Alex and Phil, who turned a deaf ear to Dev spouting his nonsense, and a second protection officer, Peter Huddle, who clearly loathed Detective Sergeant Stonehouse. "He's like hemorrhoids," he said loudly in the kitchen, "a royal pain in the ass."
I mean, it sounds kind of comedic and fun and maybe funny. And
well, one of the things you learn if you hang around with policemen is a very kind of strange strain of police humor. You know, I mean, for instance, one of the drivers, actually one of those guys, had the nickname of the King of Spain. And the reason he was called the King of Spain is that he'd once neglected his armored car briefly and it got stolen while he wasn't looking. And he was called the King of Spain because if you say the name of the King of Spain slowly, it's Juan Carlos.
Oh. That's Salman Rushdie, an excerpt of an interview I did with Salman Rushdie last year about his memoir, Joseph Anton. And I'm laughing with Christine Dempsey and the ladies from the Cosmopolitan Club of Philadelphia. It's a mini break in the middle of the best of Radio Times, in this hour of Radio Times. In fact, this hour and the next hour, we are playing excerpts of interviews that you said you enjoyed. And frankly, we did as well. I have to say, the first time I met Salman Rushdie, and he was still living under a fatwa, or the very sort of end of the fatwa, and there he was just sitting all by himself at the front of the building. I'd expect armed guards and dogs and all that, and he was just this charming conversationalist that you hear today, with a wonderful sense of humor and an extraordinary life.
What year was that? Do you remember?
I don't. It was probably 15 years ago, mm-hmm. something like that. But I've interviewed him several times over the years, and I have to say he's just a wonderful conversationalist. We believe that you enjoy things like that as well. We want you to be a member here at WHYY, 1-888-345-9499. We are looking for 80 calls during this hour of Radio Times. We have about 14 in, so clearly we have our work cut out for us, but we can do it when you make that pledge at 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org.
1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Salman Rushdie talked about the ending of his last book, which
That's
was
right.
actually a genuine happy ending.
Yes.
This is great. Here, this is where I'm going, Marty.
I hear it.
You can have a happy ending right here if you become a member of WHYY. Actually, it'll be happy for us because that means we reached the goal, but we can't reach it without you. We do the program for you. We broadcast all of the programs that we do for you. And now we are asking you to be here for us, for WHYY, for Radio Times. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Marty, you know, you get a bill in the mail, and it tells you how much you must pay in order to get a service, right? So you pay that amount.
That's right.
It doesn't work like that here. You decide what you can pay, what it is worth to you. Does it fit into your budget? You answer all of those questions, and then you make the call. And you may even go for years without making that call. Well, now is the time to step up. You've gone for years without doing it. Now is the time to help WHYY out. We have 20 calls in so far for that goal of 80, which is great, but we have 20 minutes left to reach it in. I can't do it because I already have done it. Marty's already done it.
That's right.
The folks here have already done it. We're waiting for you to make that phone call. 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org.
It's our early spring mini membership drive, and we hope to do this in just a couple of days, 2 days, and we need to raise a lot of money. I'll be completely honest with you about that. Looking for 80 calls during this hour of Radio Times, but we know from audience figures, it's not like we're looking in your windows or anything like that, but we know that you're listening to W, although maybe Christine does, I don't know.
Part of the job, Marty.
Part of her job description, not mine, though. I'm with you on the radio, coming out of your radio, and we know that Radio Times is part of your day. It's long-form interviews. Call me old-fashioned. I like guests in the studio, and I like to talk to them. I believe in conversation. And I think Salman Rushdie is a good example of what you can get out of a conversation. You can talk about literature. You can talk about someone's life. You can talk about a fatwa in his case. We introduce you to all sorts of people like Salman Rushdie. That's why you listen to Radio Times, and it's now important to make that next step and be a supporter, a subscriber of WHYY. why. Where does your money go? Your money goes and is invested in the programs that you listen to, like Radio Times. So you're here with us. We want you to take that next step, and we want you to be a member. You'll feel great about it. We've got folks here from the Cosmopolitan Club of Philadelphia. They will take your call. They will sign you up. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll be getting to another interview, part of the Best of Radio Times, talking about education, something we know that many people care deeply about, including us. So make a call. 1-888-345-9499.
Yeah, I'm going to elaborate a little bit. When you, Marty, you said, where does your money go? Actually, your money buys the time for this long-form interview. That is the bottom line here. If you enjoy long-form interviews, and you do because you listen to Radio Times, then make it possible, because your membership dollars buys the time for Marty to sit down with an author for an hour, or an educator for an hour, or a celebrity for an hour. That's what your dollars go to. It goes to time. You get the time to hear that in-depth interview. If you don't make the call, the time's not there.
Well, in fact, in just a couple of seconds, we'll be getting to our third interview, part of the Best of Radio Times. And it's called Radio Times because it is about time in many ways. And again, we've been here for 27 years doing interviews, introducing you to all sorts of interesting people, keeping you informed about the world, the ever-changing world that we are all living in. And we believe that we provide an important service to you, and we want you to make that next step and become a member subscriber. That phone number again, 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. And we do appreciate those calls coming in, but make sure that we do not lag. Well, we do know that there is a topic that you care deeply about, and it is education. We do as well. Here's an excerpt of an interview with journalist Amanda Ridley about her book called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. It's what Americans can learn from school systems in Finland, in Poland, and South Korea. I asked her about why she picked these three countries.
There are sort of three models that I divided the world into, and one is the utopian model of Finland, which is a place where, you know, kids are reaching the top of the world on a test of critical thinking and math, reading, and science. They have about a 90% high school graduation rate compared to about 75, 76% in the U.S. And they get there without making their kids work night and day and do, you know, hundreds of hours of homework. So that's really the holy grail. And I wanted to see it because I couldn't quite believe it, honestly. And then there's another model, which would be the pressure cooker model. Korea is the extreme case of this, but you see this all over Asia in particular, where, you know, there's a huge amount of pressure on kids, huge drive to get education. And that's another way to get to the same place, a far more grueling way.
And in the middle? In
the middle is the metamorphosis, the countries that are transitioning from being below average to above. And Poland is a great example of that.
Well, let's begin with Finland. And what's interesting and what you write about and even what your student who was there doing the experience of going to these schools is that the teachers seem to be better trained, better prepared. In fact, Finland closed their teacher colleges. The focus, a lot of focus on teacher training.
Right. What we've seen in all the top-performing countries in the world, that it's much more efficient and effective to start from the beginning, to make it very selective, to get into teacher training colleges, and to make the training rigorous and relevant. We currently educate twice as many teachers as we need in the United States in a huge number of education colleges of wildly varying quality, which is what Finland did too until they buckled down in 1968 and shut down their teacher training colleges and reopened them in the most elite universities in the land.
And teachers are paid pretty well in Finland.
They are, although not as much as I expected. I mean, you know, what you find is that pay is not tightly correlated with education outcomes. So the highest paid teachers in the world are actually in Spain, which does not have impressive education outcomes for a variety of reasons. But they are paid more than our teachers in Finland and more closely to what other professionals would make.
So what happens inside a classroom in Finland that results in such good academic performance?
They get less homework on average than American kids, but it's more challenging. So, you know, it's not sort of cutting and pasting and going through the motions, but it's actually challenging work. So Finland went very long on quality over quantity, which is sort of the opposite of what we've done. So one thing you see is actually the schools are typically not super high tech. That's true in all these countries. What you see is they've really invested in the teaching and the leadership of the school. And in general, kids have a lot more autonomy in Finland. That's partly a cultural difference.
Autonomy sort of within the school building, within the school curriculum, that students in Finland have more choice?
Well, they have more control over their time. There's a real cultural value on self-sufficiency in Finland and just sort of inner grit. And that is something that partly comes from a place being so cold and dark and remote. But it's also something you can actively cultivate.
You talk about the critical thinking skills that get developed under this system in Poland. Is it that it's more rigorous, more sort of high-level academic curriculum?
That is part of it, for sure. All these countries at some point decided to agree on a common set of standards for what kids should know, and it was higher than the previous set of standards. So this is something the U.S. is actually going through now with 45 states adopting the Common Core State Standards and also maybe backing away from it. There's a lot of controversy over this. So, but that is actually encouraging to me that we're doing something that these countries have already done to great effect.
And do they have extracurricular activities? Do they have drama? Do they have sports? Do they have recess in Finland?
Oh, yeah, lots of recess. Finland is particularly famous for recess. But all these countries, you know, kids do play sports and kids watch TV and kids, you know, get on Facebook. I mean, there's a lot of similarities. One thing that is really different that the kids I followed picked up on right away is that when they play sports, it's really kind of on their own and informal or through a community rec center. It's not part of the mission of school.
There's a lot of talk in this country about the role that parents play, parental involvement in their children's education. You seem to be saying in this book, looking at these three schools, Finland, Poland, and South Korea, is that parental involvement is a given, that of course parents are involved in their children's education.
Well, it's interesting because it's a different kind of involvement than we think of parental involvement. And this seems to make all the difference. So American parents are actually, statistically speaking, pretty involved in their kids' schools. But when you go to schools in Finland, one thing you don't see is parents. I mean, you don't see them in Korean schools either. And Korean parents are obsessively involved in their kids' education, I mean, to the point of dysfunction in many cases, as they'll be the first to admit. So the difference is they're involved at home in their kids' education. They see part of their job, particularly in Korea, as coaching their child from a very young age to learn how to work hard, how to make mistakes and recover, to become fluent in math from a very young age. And these are things that they do with their child just as a matter of course.
Tell us why Poland, as you describe, is a country that had some problems and is working to solve some of those education problems.
Poland is really fascinating and was a great mystery to me because Poland has 15% child poverty rate, which is high for the developed world, comparable to that of the U.S. And yet, in the past 10 years, they've dramatically improved their education results in different measures. So I wanted to know how they did that. This is a big country with a historical distrust for the central government and plenty of trauma in its background. So in some ways it felt more relevant to many states within the U.S. than, say, Finland.
So what did they do to try to transform their education system?
You know, they were under enormous economic pressure to catch up with the rest of Europe. You know, they wanted to be a place where there were good jobs to be had, and they didn't want to be lumped together with some of the other former communist countries. So in a big bout of reform, some of which was by accident, some of which was on purpose, one thing they did is they delayed separating their kids into vocational and academic tracks just by 1 year. So they went from 15 to 16. This created all sorts of new opportunities because they had to open up 4,000 new middle schools to absorb all these kids who would have normally gone to vocational school.
Does that make sense to you?
You know, it does, because it's actually something that really applies to the U.S. But it turns out we actually track kids more aggressively at an earlier age than most developed countries in the world. But we do it in kind of camouflaged ways, you know. So we have, like, gifted and talented programs when you're 6 years old. And then, you know, that leads to honors classes, which leads to AP classes. And, you know, you're actually taking dramatically different content most of your career compared to the kids sitting next to you in kindergarten.
Amanda, one of the words that you came up with to describe these three school systems, Poland, South Korea, which we will get to, and also in Finland, is rigor. Rigor for the teachers, rigor for the parents, rigor for the children.
Rigor to me means hard work that's relevant and challenging and engaging and worth doing. It's the kind of attitude that many of us here have towards sports. It's the exact same thing. It's just literally do a find replace, and it's the exact same. It's like serious practice for hours a day in many cases. And if you're not good at something, what do? You mm-hmm. practice until you get better. And it's, you know, there's a clear contest at the end, and it's a high goal. And there's this kind of constant sense that we can all get better, of continuous improvement.
But would it be fair to say that good American schools look like some of these schools that we have been talking about and that are described in your book?
I've been in American schools that are far superior to any school I saw in any of these countries. And I should make that clear. I probably should have said it sooner. You know, I have been in unbelievable classrooms in America. And it's like this combination of really, really valuable things, where they might have a very diverse group of kids, and they might have a lot of interaction and engagement and argument back and forth, which is very unusual in most of the world, right? But really helpful for 21st century skills and thinking critically. But then also there's this very high baseline of rigor, and there's almost an overestimation of what kids can do rather than an underestimation.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions about South Korea. And you describe the pressure cooker environment in South Korea, where it seems as if students go to school just about all day and all night.
It's unbelievable. And the student that I followed, Eric, who went from Minnesota to South Korea, just, you know, he could not get over it. The first day he went to school, first of all, he looks back in his first class and he sees that like a third of the class is asleep, you know, which is not what he expected. I mean, Korea is a country where there's, you know, sort of big priority on respect and so forth, deference. And the reason they're asleep, he eventually discovers, is that they're going to these after-school tutoring academies until late into the night, and then maybe taking more online classes after that. So there's this incessant and insane schedule that kids are following, particularly in high school, to prepare for the test at the end of high school.
And is this pressure coming from the schools themselves, from the children themselves, or the kids, the students, their families, the teachers?
Their families, yeah. Their family. It's definitely coming from their families. And again, this is true to some degree all over the world, especially in Asia, where they have these tests that create this unbelievable meritocracy in some ways. I mean, literally, if you score above a certain point on this one test that you take at the end of high school, then you're accepted into the top colleges. They don't care if mm-hmm. your parents went there, if you play volleyball on a varsity team. It's like it's 100% clear. Now, that isn't meritocratic in some ways, right? Because you could be really good at some things and not good at this test. So it's a complicated situation and a really fascinating laboratory mm-hmm. that is cautionary tale as well.
And again, another interview that you said you enjoyed on Radio Times. That's journalist Amanda Ridley. Her book is called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are playing excerpts of the best of Radio Times. And education is always a topic that gets a big audience response. No matter how we talk about it on Radio Times, we get lots of calls, we get lots of emails, lots of posts on Facebook and Twitter as well. I'm with Christine Dempsey. We have some of the ladies from the Cosmopolitan Club of Philadelphia, and we are here to remind you about the important role you play as a listener and member of WHYY. We need to make up for some lost ground from earlier this winter. It was a terrible winter, as we all know, and we paid a bit of a price for that, but we're going to make it up today at 1-888-345-9499. That's the phone number to call to be a member, a supporter of WHYY. We need to hear from 80 people in this hour, and Christine, we're about 33 there. We have some work cut out for us, but we can do it.
Right, and the only way we do get to the goal is with your help. And the goal is set so we can close that shortfall up.
Right.
So that's why we're asking you to make a call right now and support Radio Times. The number is 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. At this point, Marty, we are looking for 45 more people to support Radio Times.
Easy.
That helps us reach that goal. And we have about 5 minutes or so to do it in. That means, listen, it's not going to happen. If you listen and you don't hear the phone ringing or you don't hear the web pinging, it doesn't happen. It only happens with you, with your help, with you taking action right now. And you do that simply by, first of all, well, you've made the commitment. You've done that part. You've made the commitment to Radio Times because you're listening. Now you have to take that action. Go to the phone or take it out of your pocket. Dial 1-888-345-9499, even though you can't dial anymore. 1-888-345-9499. Go online to whyy.org and make it happen. But it's not happening because you are not stepping up, and we need you to step up right now.
And what you're hearing in this hour of Radio Times, three very different interviews. We began with a puzzle maker, Merle Riegel, and we heard an excerpt of an interview with Salman Rushdie, and now Amanda Ridley talking about education. That's what Radio Times does every day. 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, we bring you a diverse assortment of interviews and people that can engage you in the world, they can help explain the world to you, they can make you mad, they can inspire you, they can make you cry. Hopefully we do all of that. That's part of our job. But we need to hear from you right now. We need to stay on track. It's important that we do that. It's a mini goal, mini membership drive here, making up for some lost time. So do make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. We will know that when we hear those pings. And yes, we are on the air. It's a long form interview, but there's so many different ways to access a show like Radio Times, through social media, through Facebook, through Twitter. We are here in many different ways. You can podcast the program. You can listen online. You can listen on Sirius Satellite Radio. We're here for you in as many diverse ways as we can possibly be. We want you to be here for us as well, and frankly, to be here for yourself. And again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. Pledge right now, 1-888-345-WHYY. Pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks.